Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program. Matthew Quick, welcome to Right Turn Radio. We're here to talk about your new book, Every Exquisite Thing. But we also want to hear a little bit of your story as a creative person who has written about mental health issues in his novels and has also had his own struggles with depression and anxiety. Welcome to Right Turn Radio, Matthew Quick.
So, I mean, one of the things I loved about this book as compared to your other ones is that I read a lot of young adult fiction because my daughter's a young adult and she says, "Mom, you should read this." But there wasn't a disease of the week. The parents were doing their best. They weren't great at it, but they were trying. She didn't just do the rebellious thing. She tried to go back and do it the right way. I just felt like it was a very different approach. And, some of the criticism was you didn't go deeply into the other girls and all that stuff. But it felt to me like you really got what it was like for most high school students to be in high school. They all are faking it differently. And and I wanted you to kind of talk about what it's like to be a teacher looking at these kids doing it, faking it.
And yeah, well, thank you for saying that. My experience with most teenagers is, they're trying their best to do whatever the adults in their lives are telling them to do. And they don't have a lot of self-awareness, and they don't really understand what's going on with the rest of the kids in their school because most of them are putting on a face as well. So you have a lot of black and white thinking. And so, Nanette, she's a very limited amount of life experience. And I think she's a really bright kid, and she's very intuitive. She has a great emotional intelligence, but she doesn't realize that there could be other people out there who feel exactly the way that she does. And I think part of that is because she's an introvert, and, most people are either extroverted or they're coached on how to be extroverted. And in schools, we teach that being an introvert is bad. So, you suppress that and you hide that. So she doesn't see a lot of other people who are like-minded. It was important for me not to demonize her parents because they also are extroverts, and they don't really get what's going on with her. And I saw that time and time again when I was teaching that, kids who had parents that weren't like them were reluctant to tell their parents, "I'm not like you." that you want to be like your parents. And so I would have parent-teacher conferences when I was teaching, and halfway through I would realize, you have no idea who your kid is. It was amazing. And these were good parents who were involved in their kids' lives, but the kids were acting for them too. And I think that's kind of what's going on with Nanette and her parents. Like, her parents have said, if you want to please us, you have to do these things. And Nanette very much wants to please her parents. And so she does them to her own detriment, especially from a mental health standpoint. She does them until she's literally sick and she can't do it anymore. And, her parents have to recalibrate their expectations. And I would see that again and again and again. I mean, whether it was simply, a parent forcing their student to take my honors accelerated class when they had no business being in that class, and they keep coming in every day and saying, "I can't do this. I don't have the abilities that the other students do." And the parents would say, "Not my kid. They're brilliant." So I think that there's that gap, and I think it's really human because the parents want the best for the kids, and the kids want to please the parents. And sometimes we forget really to have that honest conversation.
Yeah, I have a question for you. In this, the big thing, the thing in this plot is that there's a book that the kind of alternative kids all fall in love with. Was there a book like that for you? Is there literature like that for you?
As a teenager, there was. I grew up in a very religious household, a very fundamentalist Christian household, and so when I read pretty much any of my favorite authors, they were saying things that were very different than what my parents and the leaders of my church were saying. I remember reading Kurt Vonnegut for the first time and realizing that he had a lot of things to say that I agreed with, and I knew that would make my parents very angry if they read those books. And I remember reading Camus for the first time and reading about existentialism and, you know, really looking through looking at the religion that I had heard it through the lens of Camus and existentialism, and, you know, really questioning for the first time, and also realizing at 18 years of age that, you know, reading Camus was a revolutionary act because it put me at odds with all of the people whom I loved in my life, who were very religious people. And that was an uncomfortable discovery for me, you know, because at 18, I would have very much rather remained ignorant and, you know, just had the approval of my grandfather, whom I loved. But as I formed my own opinions and my own worldview, that put me at odds with my grandfather, who we had a relationship until the day that I died, but it made it uncomfortable. It was easier when I just accepted everything that he told me at 15. You know, that made it very easy for us to have a relationship. And so I think, you know, you see this time and time again. When I was teaching, I taught in a very almost exclusively white school, and I remember teaching Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man.
Ooh.
And it made my students like very, very uncomfortable to read that book. But it was important because, you know, they needed to know that other people in America are having radically different experiences than they are. You know, I used to tell my students that education is painful. You know, we kind of think that, you know, education should be fun, and, you know, we have this idea that school should be fun. But, you know, when you learn, it's hardly ever fun because it takes you out of your comfort zone. And that's something that I believe in very much.
So the other thing I was thinking about the books are, you must be hoping to reach people with these or expecting to reach people. Do you get feedback? I know you're good with your boundaries, but do you get feedback? Do people talk to you about how important your books are? Things like that. What have you heard?
Yeah, I mean, I don't do a lot of social media. I do a little bit. I don't really like doing social media because it blurs boundaries. But I hear on Twitter and Facebook from readers. Sometimes I get handwritten letters in the mail. I have a P.O. box, and that's actually how I would prefer to receive information. And I do get very intense letters from adults, but more so usually from teenagers. I've received many from already for Every Truth of Thing, and particularly I have a book called Forgive Me, Leonard Peacock, that I receive a lot of fan mail from. And it's both very heartening and disturbing at the same time, because the letters are almost always the same. And what they'll say is, you understand me in a way that the people in my community don't, or your book made me feel less alone, which of course is the highest compliment that you can receive as a writer, and you always want to make people feel less alone. That's why I went to literature when I was a teenager. But the flip side of that is you realize that these kids are in an environment where they feel completely isolated and as if nobody understands them. A lot of times they're kids that are introverts. They're kids that are suffering from depression and not getting the help that they need. And it's tough because I've talked about this a lot. You know, my teacher training was, you know, when you walk into a classroom, you take care of every kid in the room. You're student-centered. But, of course, when you're an author, you can't take care of every reader in the world.
No.
You know, so it's when I get these letters, at first, when I first started to publish, I would write, you know, these five-page letters back, you know, I'd be so honored, and I just wanted to help everybody. But along the way, I had to come to understand that the book is the thing that I put in the world to help people. And in every sort of thing, I talk about some of that. Because I've had, you know, Nanette has this book that she loves called The Bubblegum Reaper, and she gets to meet the author, and she peppers him with all these questions that she wants answered, not only about the book, but about life. And that happens a lot when a teenager writes me. They want to know information about the book, and then they want me to tell them what to do with their life. And it is always difficult for me to kind of negotiate that, to say, you know, like, hey, like, I just wrote a book, and the book is the thing that I have to offer, and it ends there. And you've got to figure it out as the reader. You've got to not only understand the book, you know, that's all you have as a reader, but also you have to use it as a tool to decide what you should do in your life. And that's pretty much where the relationship ends between author and reader, which of course is not an answer that teenagers want to hear.
But I do think, I mean, not to give the end away at all, but I think what you, I think you wrapped up some things, and you, I think everybody realized that everybody changed a little, and that's the point of good fiction, is that people change a little and something happens, and, you know, everybody did a little work, and it was nice to see.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that. You know, obviously, I want to make people think, you know, when I write a book, and I hope that that leads to positive change. You know, you never want to be didactic. You know, it's not an after-school special book. You know, it's not...
or Disease of the Week.
...clear moral. What's that?
It's not Disease of the Week.
No, it's you know, hopefully it's something that leaves you with a lot of questions to ponder, you know, and I think that's the power of literature, not only for teenagers, but for all of us, you know, adults as well. You know, we should be questioning. There's a quote that a lot of authors throw around that I'm very fond of about, you know, what literature should do, and a lot of people will say that the purpose of literature is to comfort the disturbed and disturb the comforted.
Nicely put.
I think that's true, you know, that's me, you know, and when people get angry, and I get those letters too about something that I've written, I often say to myself, like, I wonder what button was pushed there, you know, what issue that they're dealing with that the book would make them so angry. And even that response, why it's not pleasant for me to get a letter or an email from somebody who's angry about my book, it still let me know that I accomplished what I set out to do, which was to make people think and maybe to push people a little bit out of their comfort zone, because that's where change happens.
Matthew, what was your path like through your adolescence and through depression and anxiety? And how did you get through that period of your life?
I knew that I was not like my friends at a very early age. You know, I have memories of, you know, 11 years old, 10 years old, you know, around that time, like needing to withdraw, needing time alone, and feeling very odd about that. I also realized that I would have moods that my friends didn't have, times when I just didn't feel happy and there was no real reason why. You know, looking back, you know, I can say, you know, obviously from a genetic standpoint or, you know, a chemical standpoint, you know, there's stuff going on. But of course, when you're a teenager and you grow up, you know, in the 80s in, you know, a blue collar town, nobody was talking about mental health. Nobody, you know, that was so taboo that I would never even admit to feeling sad, let alone try to talk to somebody about what was going on. So I learned to suppress it. You know, I feel very sad and go through, cycle through my emotions. You know, I put on a, you know, the Smiths and go, you know, by the lake and feel sad at a time. And, you know, and I didn't really understand why I enjoyed so much listening to Morrissey, but it's because it allowed me to cycle through those feelings and to feel sad and to feel what was going on inside of me in a very private way with, you know, a cassette and some headphones. But through high school, I would say I was pretty good at faking it. You know, I was pretty good at putting on a face at my church. I was pretty good at putting on a face for my parents. But when I got to college, of course, it was, you know, you leave your home, you leave, you know, your friends, what you know, and it's all new. And, of course, that really spiked my anxiety. And also it was a time when I was realizing that the values and the ideas that was taught by my church, you know, I was kind of not on board with all of them anymore. So I lost that too, you know, which was, you know, say what you will about religion, you know, whether you're for it or against, it makes you part of a tribe that makes you feel safe. And so when I let go of that, I felt very vulnerable. And I went through some pretty bad breakdowns privately, my freshman year in college. And I remember everybody going out to parties on Friday nights, and I would lock myself in my dorm room and smoke two packs of cigarettes and just kind of shake. I didn't understand what was happening. I was very afraid. And I was so scared to tell anyone because I had no idea, you know, that I was having breakdowns, that I was depressed, that, you know, my anxiety had taken over my life to the point that I was so exhausted that I couldn't leave a room. And so I would stay in the room and just gather up enough energy to try to make it through the next day. You know, there's a line in Silver Linings Playbook, the movie, where Bradley Cooper says white knuckling it. And right. That wasn't my line. That was David O. Russell's line. But that really struck me because I realized I did that for about 10 years.
You were just hanging on to the ledge, hoping
That's
you wouldn't
it. Yeah.
fall into the pit.
You know, there was part of me that really wanted to let go and just fall to your death, you know. And I never made any attempt at suicide, but it was something that was in the back of my mind. You know, I knew that I was not finding pleasure in life.
Did you
formed a relationship with my then girlfriend, now wife, who was the first person to really start to tell me, like, this isn't normal. You know, I let her in, and she said, you have to start working on this. But I thought I could tough it out. And, you know, when I started to student teach, I would go into a school every day and be surrounded by people and be giving me impossible expectations and tasks. And I'm also a perfectionist. And so if you tell me to do X, Y, and Z, I'm going to try to do X, Y, and Z, even if everyone else knows that that's an impossible task. And teachers are told every day to go in and do impossible things. And veteran teachers know that you're not going to do those impossible things. You know, you're going to try to do as much as you can. But young, idealistic me really thought I was failing every day because I couldn't do
everything.
Everything, exactly. And so I would teach, and I would come home, and I would lesson plan obsessively because I was so anxious that I needed to have a plan and prepare for every second of the day. And I would lesson plan until I was exhausted until 11:30 at night, and then I would hit the gin bottle and, you know, I would drink until I could fall asleep, and that's what I would do. And
How did you get out of this cycle?
I taught. My first job out of college was at a place called Bancroft in Haddonfield, New Jersey, and my job was to transition teenagers who were diagnosed with severe autism from a lockdown unit to a classroom and then work with them every day. And it was an amazing year because for the first time in my life, I was in an environment where it was safe to talk about mental health. And everybody was very open, and you know, it was the norm there to be aware of your mental health. And I was a smoker at the time, and I remember any time, you know, even I went to orientation, the first thing they said is, like, if you're stressed out during the day, like, go for a cigarette break, like, take a break. Like, we don't want you stressed out. We don't want you anxious. And that simple statement was something I'd never heard before, that someone would say, like, you can take a break. Like, we don't want you anxious. Like, it's okay to take care of your mental health. Like, step out of the classroom whenever you need to. Clear your head. And at the time, you know, this is 1996, I'd never heard anyone say that. I'd never heard anyone tell me that, you know, you should take care of your mental health. And that was a radical shift. And I felt really healthy that year. When I was working with these kids, in contrast to my student teaching, where I was told, it doesn't matter how you feel, like, you need to do these amazing things and be given impossible task after impossible task, and we don't really care how you feel, like, you need to do these things, and that's the way it goes, or you're not going to get your diploma. So that was a radical shift, and I felt very healthy that year. My drinking tapered off, but of course I was making, I think I was making $8.50 an hour.
Yeah, we know.
I was living with my parents, and when my girlfriend graduated from college, we wanted to get married and live on our own, obviously, and so I needed a quote-unquote real job, and the only thing I had was a teaching certificate, so I went right back into the cycle of teaching high school English. Not necessarily because I wanted to, but because I didn't feel as though I had any other options, you know, to help pay my student loans and, you know, to support myself. And I remember when I got the job, my wife was like, remember student teaching, do you really want to go back into this environment? And I had such a great year that I said, no, it'll be different. It'll be different. It was different for a little bit. Like, I felt like I learned at Bancroft, like, some coping mechanisms. And, you know, I needed to take care of myself a little better. But it kind of culminated towards the end, you know, after 8 years of doing it and, you know, seeing the ugliness of the system and realizing that, you know, most people put much more stock into a college acceptance letter rather than, you know, the mental health of the community. And seeing, like, mental health issues pushed to the side again and again, I realized that this was not a good place for me. And I felt very sick at the end of my teaching career, secretly. My former students are always surprised when I talk about this, but I was severely depressed and, you know, definitely using alcohol to medicate. And it was my wife who said, again, you know, she's time and time again, you know, I always tell people that's the most important thing, have a good partner in life. She sat me down and said, you know, we can't do this anymore. Like, this has gone beyond, you know, she said she couldn't do it anymore and we needed to make this radical change or you know, that was it for us. You know, it was like really kind of this rock bottom conversation. And that's when we decided to sell our house. And, you know, we traveled for a while. And, you know, we started this life as artists. And her parents had allowed us to live with them for a while, which is very humbling. You know, I come from a Protestant family, you know, Protestant work ethic. You don't take handouts. And so it's very easy to say, you know, oh, you know, we're not going to feel sorry for you because you had to live with your in-laws and you live rent-free. But those 3 years were really hard for me because it went against everything I was taught. You know, you don't take handouts. And, of course, my family, they weren't artists. So they didn't really, at the time, considered what I was doing as real work. You know, so my family had made me feel as though, you know, I was just playing, you know, with writing. You know, it wasn't something that was serious. Nobody takes art serious until you start making money. And everybody.
That's right.
When does that happen?
That happened about 3.5 years after I quit my teaching job. I did an MFA program at Goddard in Vermont, and we did well on the sale of our house. We got very lucky. We sold it right before the economy crashed, and I used that money to travel. And I used that money to go to grad school. And it was very odd because just at the midnight hour when we had exhausted all of our funds, we had no money, that's when I got an agent and we sold Silver Linings.
That's such a nice story. I want to say, and this book is being made into a movie, right?
What's that?
Is this book going to be made into a movie too?
Yeah, actually, the Weinstein Company has every exclusive thing as well, and so we've sold all the rights to all of my books.
Oh, that's great.
And yeah, it's great, and I feel very lucky that that happened. And people make a lot of, you know, again, like, people don't take this seriously until, like, you make money, right? And that's what everybody respects. And I'm quick to point out, especially to the mental health community, that I didn't make the break from teaching and start writing because I thought that I'd be going to the Oscars one day. I did it because I felt like I wasn't going to be able to keep living if I didn't make a break.
I want to say, you know, that's a great line.
Yeah, that's a wonderful message. Matthew,
thank you for sharing so much with us.
Yeah, we have to wrap it up, but we really appreciate just you sharing part of your story with us. We appreciate the writing. We'd love to have you back on Right Turn Radio because you're our people and you speak our language, and we love the work you do, and continue doing it.
And I can't wait to share it with my daughter and say, you should read this one.
Well, I have a book out next summer, so I'd love to come back.
Okay, that's great.
We'll have you back. Thanks so much, Matthew.
All right, thank you.
You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.